Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Death happens on a single day, a moment when we cross from this life into the next. But dying can take weeks or even months, giving people the chance to decide how they want to die. That's where end-of-life doulas come in, professionals who can help you choose everything from the place and the people you want around you to the music you want played when the time comes. Over the course of the next hour, we're sitting down with two end-of-life doulas to talk about their work and answer your questions. Joining me in studio are Nikki Smith, an end-of-life doula and grief coach here in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Greg Brown, an end-of-life doula instructor for the University of Vermont, who happens to be based here in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
I want to start our conversation by unpacking the idea of a good death, because I think that's such a personal idea. Does it mean free from pain, surrounded by family, passing in your sleep one night without ever waking up? How do we begin to define what a good death looks like? And Nikki, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, a good death is going to be different for everybody, like you said. For some folks, it might be surrounded by family, peacefully at home. For others, it might be outside. For some, it could be completely alone and isolation. For some people, it might be quiet and in your sleep so that you don't quite recognize what's happening at the time. So it's going to be different for everybody. But to me, a good death encompasses feeling of freedom and readiness, both emotionally, spiritually, mentally.
Yeah, I second that it's different for everybody. I think a lot of us who come into this line of work, some of us come to it because we witnessed a death that was particularly tough. And we want to do what we can to make sure that the next person has a chance at making more meaning, finding more peace in their death. Others of us come at it because we've seen a particularly what you might call a good death. Mm-hmm. And we want to do what we can because we've seen that it's possible to offer support that allows that to happen. At the same time, it's as a doula, it's really important to make sure that what makes it a good death is what makes it a good death for that person. And for some people, things like anger can be a big part of that process. Nobody wants to leave their young children. Nobody wants to leave their friends. Nobody wants to leave unfinished business. And sometimes the way the cards lay out just doesn't allow for time. And there are shortcuts or important emotions that people need to feel. And so it's really important that we support people through whatever emotions come up, even if those are on the surface uglier emotions that are tougher to deal with. That's precisely the gift we can be as doulas to allow people to bring that full spectrum forward.
That leads me into my next question, which is, does a good death mean making peace with it? Basically, is it okay to be afraid or angry or upset at the end?
Absolutely. I think if you're not afraid, I wouldn't be concerned, but it's perfectly normal to be afraid up to the last moment. And it doesn't have to be acceptance. Some people never accept their death. Some people leave this world, unfortunately, feeling they have not accepted it. And that's okay. And again, as Greg pointed out, that's where we can come in as doulas to help them process that as best we can. And even if they don't accept it, make sure they're at least in some way ready.
So what exactly does an end-of-life doula do? I know that's a really big question, and we can kind of unpack it throughout the hour, but broad strokes, like, how do you view your purpose in somebody's death?
I'd like to start out by saying that it's important to acknowledge and emphasize we're not medical professionals. And so we might use the word death doula. We might get into that later. We might use the word end-of-life doula for depending on what we want to emphasize in a particular relationship with a client. But I'll mention that I would never use the word death midwife, and that's because a midwife is a medical professional. It's not because it's a gendered term for me. I'm perfectly comfortable operating in a woman-oriented space of doula care, but we just aren't medical professionals, and midwives are, and that's a big distinction to draw. What we can do is we can work with medical care teams to make sure that the patient's needs are being met. And so if a client is expressing that they're in pain, we can remind them that they have a right to be free from pain and that maybe a call to their nurse is in order. In many ways, we're not a replacement for hospice care. We're certainly a supplement for that. And I think that national average is something like 2.5% of the time that a person is on hospice care, receiving hospice care, they're with somebody from that hospice team, whether it's a social worker, a chaplain, a nurse, a personal care attendant, a doctor. But there's a lot of time that no one is there. And particularly if you're the last person to die in a relationship, or you're unpartnered, or you don't have a family, or you don't have a strong circle of support, there are certainly needs that need to be filled. And so as doulas, unlike a care team, we're not fixing anybody's problems, but we're looking for gaps in care and supporting people as they feel how they can best make meaning in their life. For me, there are certain things we do that touch on what a social worker does. There are certain things that we do that are connecting people to resources. And there are also certain things that we do that might be more akin to what a chaplain might do. But rather than coming at it from the perspective of telling somebody where they're going to find spiritual peace, we listen to them and amplify what they're saying and listen to what their needs are to offer that sort of spiritual support and meaning making at the end of life.
I read that doulas are companions to the dying, but they're never in charge. Nikki, does that strike you as an accurate description?
Absolutely. I would never give any advice as far as what choices people should make at their end of their life. I'm going to be their companion. I'm going to be their guide and let them guide me. And yeah.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Do you have questions about end-of-life care? Is this something that you're curious about? Or do you have a story that you'd like to share? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. So you guys must be on call all hours of the day and night because people don't die between 9 to 5.
We certainly can be, yes. It depends on the clients we have at the time, and every doula is going to be a little bit different as well as far as their limitations as to when they would be, quote-unquote, on call. I have that conversation with my families up front and let them know, you know, if there are certain days or hours I can't be present. But overall, I try to make myself present 24/7 to them, especially when it comes to active dying and the very end days.
It's very true. I think that a flip side, a corollary to that, is one of the things that's so peaceful and calming about end-of-life work is that there aren't really emergencies. And so while somebody might be facing an existential crisis in the middle of the night, and sometimes that's something that can be handled over the phone, just to know that somebody is there to support you. But really, at the end of life, we know what's coming, and we're not first responders, we're last responders. And one of the gifts that we can really bring to our clients is being the calmest person in the room. Yeah. And if they need to express a middle of the night scare or a fear or a worry or a sadness, we can meet them with calmness and compassion rather than rushing to amplify that moment in their heads.
Your work reminds me a lot of birth doulas or even midwives, because they are just a fundamentally different experience from going the traditional like OBGYN route for having a baby, because you're with them the whole time like a midwife or a doula would be.
Yeah, we're actually modeled after the birth doula. That's where the death doula came from. And doula, you know, we talked earlier about not using the word midwife. Doula is just from the ancient Greek word doula, which means female maidservant or female slave. So doulas, in a sense, have been around for millennia. And we just accompany them, yeah, much like a birth doula would, through the dying process only.
Yeah, because I think that's the thing a lot of people don't know about having a baby, is that if you go the OBGYN route, they show up right as the baby's, like, they check on you from time to time, yeah, but they show up right as the baby's being delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, yep, like, a doula will stay with you the whole time.
Correct. We're there before, during, and after the dying process.
So it has some parallels there, I think.
Absolutely.
The woman who created the content for the University of Vermont course in 2016 and 2017, when it was first established, who developed the curriculum, she was a birth doula before she was an end-of-life doula, and that program was modeled on the birth doula process as well.
So when people first find you, I assume it's because they've either gotten some diagnosis or they know the end is closer than perhaps they'd like. Mm-hmm. What kind of questions, what kind of potentially misconceptions do they bring to that very first meeting?
So there's a lot of misconceptions around hospice. I talk about this a lot endlessly, it feels like. And people tend to reach out to me when they've decided they don't no longer want to pursue treatment and they're ready to face their end of life. And they don't understand what hospice is. A lot of what I do is explaining when and where to hire them, what questions to ask, how to shop for your hospice, because you're not tied to just one. You have that right to pick whichever one you like. And so I just kind of help them navigate that space as well.
One of the things that I present myself as somebody who's there for somebody who doesn't necessarily have traditional circles of support. And so one of the first questions I usually get is, oh no, that can I've been kicking down the road of getting my advanced care planning together, that's something that needs to be done now. And it can feel like an insurmountable obstacle for somebody who's unpartnered. It can feel somebody who doesn't have adult children who can step into that role. How do you ask somebody to be your healthcare proxy? And how do you facilitate that conversation so it doesn't feel like it's as much as a burden? And just telling people that they're not the only one to have been in that situation, and that even people who have had long and happy marriages, somebody is going to die first. And in those cases, you'll still need somebody to make those decisions. And so what can we do to listen to your needs and your concerns about how you will be treated at the end of your life to make that less of a burden to a neighbor or a friend who might be able to step into that role? Because they're going to know your wishes, and it's really going to be just ensuring that those wishes are followed rather than having to make those difficult decisions. And so if I can be there and just normalize that fear and validate the concern and then take some actionable steps to address it, I feel like we've gotten the ball rolling in a great way.
Absolutely.
I think that is something I want to spend a little more time on, is how do you pick the person who may speak for you if you can no longer speak for you, right? How do you pick the person who will carry out your wishes and carry out your funeral the way you want? Because sometimes it may not be your partner.
Right. I always encourage people, pick somebody that you trust. And if that happens to not be your partner, so be it. I'm going to be your advocate. I will never serve as a power of attorney for any of my clients. That's crossing a line for me personally, but I will help them navigate their friend space. Is there a close friend? Is there a pastor at your church? Somebody that you really genuinely trust? Because overall, you have to pick somebody you absolutely trust. And there's cases of estrangement with family. There are folks that might not have a relationship with their family anymore or feeling, you know, neglected by them. And if they don't have this paperwork in order, the hospitals are going to go to next of kin. And if they don't have that relationship that they trust with their family, they need to have somebody else in that place.
Right. Even if you're legally separated and you've lived mm-hmm. separate lives for decades, yeah. that person is your spouse on paper.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes a spouse needs to be a spouse. And I like the fact that we're normalizing having other people step into that role. A spouse is likely going to be grieving. An adult child is going to be grieving, and what a gift it could be to perhaps designate somebody else who that you can trust to speak as you as opposed to for you. They're really amplifying your voice when you can no longer use it. And it's certainly possible to consult with an attorney to pick somebody who, well, sure, they'll coordinate, they'll loop in your family and ask them for their opinions and their feedback. But really, if you want to make sure that you're speaking for yourself, it might make sense for you to choose somebody who you're not married to, who isn't grieving in that deep way.
Mm-hmm. But you should never surprise somebody with that decision.
Absolutely.
No, I would recommend a conversation ahead of time. Take them out for coffee if you're able and ask them gently if they would be willing. And keep in mind that being somebody's power of attorney can be a burden. It's a lot of work, especially if, you know, the person has a lot of health issues, or as far as financial power of attorney, if you have a lot of financial things in your life and a lot of scope and a trust, that can be a real sticky situation, and that can be a lot of work for that person. So make sure they're up for the task.
Open and honest communication. Thank you for mentioning not surprising somebody. That doesn't just apply to end-of-life care. But if there are some cases where, say, an adult child moves in with a parent to take care of them at the end of life, and the parents might consider, you know, rewriting a will to allow that adult child to stay in the home for a while longer. And in that case, you still want to let all of the children know what's going on. You don't want to surprise people at the end. And not only is it just the kind thing to do to get that conversation rolling, it also is a chance to start talking about death and what's coming. And it's a great icebreaker when you're looking at the practical issues. Sometimes they can open up conversations about meaning and how much we love each other and those things that aren't necessarily easy for us to talk about.
That was Greg Brown, an end-of-life doula instructor who is based here in Columbus. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to take your questions about end-of-life and the conversations you should be having before you get there. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or if you don't want to be on air, email allsides@wosu.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about end-of-life doulas this hour and what it means to, quote, have a good death. Still with me are Nikki Smith, an end-of-life doula and grief coach, and Greg Brown, an end-of-life doula instructor, for the University of Vermont. I want to take a call from Paul in Hilliard. Welcome to All Sides, Paul.
Hi, Anna. I think you're doing a great job with All Sides.
Oh, thank you.
I'm 70. We have Alzheimer's in my family, and watching, like, my mother, the process that where she was just totally out of it, but we kept her alive for the very end. I didn't like it, so I thought, well, when I get to the point where I am no longer cognizant, I'm not making my own decisions, I'm just a shell of myself that basically stopped feeding me. You know, talk to doctors, and that's a very viable thing to do. They can keep you comfortable. It takes about a week. So I was just calling to, you know, get your opinion on that tact I've chosen.
I'll jump in on that one. And kudos to you, first of all, for making these decisions now. When it comes to things like Alzheimer's or dementia, if that is something that is in your family, I always encourage people to start making your decisions now while you still are of sound mind. And as far as what you've opted for your end-of-life plans, in our field, we call that VSED, which is voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And it does take time. It's different for every person, again. And that's one way to ensure your end-of-life goes the way you want it. I think that's a perfectly noble decision for anybody. As of right now, medical aid in dying is not legalized in Ohio and is not really an option for people with Alzheimer's anyway, which is very unfortunate. So, yeah, I think you made a wise choice with that.
And Greg, what do we have to do legally to make sure these decisions are protected? Because I could see a world in which family would be very uncomfortable with that choice.
I really can't speak as an attorney. I'm not one. But I can say that if I were personally faced with that situation, that would be a situation where I would explain to my attorney my needs and my fears and how can we create a document that is a little more tightly created to make sure that my needs are expressed and my concerns are expressed, and that then what I might approach a doula for is, well, how do I choose an advocate who can ensure that in the day-to-day living that I'm doing, these wishes are expressed? I can say that a lot of times it's the caregivers and the family that are going to need that doula support, that doulas are always supporting the circle around a person, a social circle, a family circle, a community circle around a family. But in in cases where people are living with Alzheimer's and dementia, sometimes that the tables are tilt to providing a little more support toward family and a little less toward the person, because perhaps a person's not, who's living with Alzheimer's isn't experiencing existential crisis in the same way that we might be if we're of sounder mind, but everybody needs support. And a doula is in a wonderful position to explain to a caregiving team, this is the sort of music that brings comfort to the client. This is the sort of, rather than leaning into correction and redirection, to really just, in some ways, caring for somebody with dementia is a lot like the doula approach to care anyway, which is where we insist on meeting somebody exactly where they are. And if somebody is saying, experiencing a delusion, rather than saying, no, you're not experiencing that right now, to comfort them through that delusion and to acknowledge that what they see is very real to them. And so where I might not be able to speak to the legal aspects of that, just the general approach to care and supporting people who are losing somebody in real time, we can certainly step up to provide that support.
So let's talk a little bit about how we pick someone to help. So are there credentials or certifications we should be looking for? How do we just should we go off the feeling that we have when we meet with them? Like, how do we decide if somebody is going to be a good fit?
Yeah, I usually have a couple initial meetings with a family to let them talk to me. I talk to them. And I mean, it's also, are they a good fit for me? They might not recognize that my skill set's not what they're looking for. Every end of life doula has a different set of skills or different, you know, things they specialize in, a different specialty. And they might be looking for something that Greg would be better at than I would, or one of the other doulas in Columbus. But as far as like a certification, there is no one overarching certification for death doulas currently anywhere. There are different training programs that are available. We talked a little bit about the University of Vermont. I received my training through ANELDA, the International End of Life Doula Association. Most of these programs have their own certification program tied into it, which you can, you know, take advantage of. So you can look for that if that's something that means something to you. But honestly, you don't need a certification. You don't even need formal training, although I would highly, highly encourage it for anybody who wants to be an end-of-life doula. But it's more, is this person going to honor my wishes? Do I trust this person? Do they vibe well with me and my family? Will they be a good voice for me when I can no longer speak for myself?
And family here could mean non-blood relatives, right?
Correct. I always say family or loved ones because, if there's no family left, or if they're estranged from their family and they're just surrounded by really close friends or people of their faith, that's family in my opinion.
And having a conversation about death is not always easy. So how do we begin, say, having those difficult conversations with our, what we would define as our family? Once, say, we've had a terminal diagnosis and we're no longer continuing care.
It's going to take courage no matter how you slice it. That first conversation is so, so difficult for the person who's bringing it up and for the circle of support. I think a little bit of bluntness can go a long way. And I have been asked as a doula to just be there as that person. When a few times that's happened where a potential client reaches out and says, I just need somebody to get the conversation started. I can't walk into that room by myself. And I think that's very real. I think when I knew my own mother was dying, then the first time to walk into the hospital room and to, you feel, it's really hard to just pass through that threshold. But once you do, things kind of click in. So if we can just say, you know what, say it. And express the diagnosis, express the prognosis. And then what we can do to support that person is to listen. We have very, very good intentions when we say, oh, well, this treatment might be available, or I know somebody who, and then we can refer to the battle terminology, especially when it's cancer, and fight, fight, fight. But if we really listen to what the person is expressing and acknowledge the grief and the fear and just the difficulty of that moment and sit with it, knowing that we can't fix it right then, that the person is looking to share their fear and to share what's going on in their head. And if we can support that and resist the urge to speak or to minimize in some way, we're doing a huge service to our loved ones. It, And that's not to say there's not hope in a given situation. Some people's cancers will be cured. But if somebody's having that conversation that they've been delivered some pretty devastating news, sometimes it's best to just acknowledge that can't be fixed and just to sit with it and maybe allow another 10 seconds for that awkward pause for the person to continue when they find their own strength again.
Nikki, I suspect one of the hardest conversations to have is when the person dying is ready, but their family's not ready for them to sort of, quote, stop fighting yet.
Absolutely. And that's, again, we talked earlier about having a healthcare proxy that you trust. That's a very hard thing for families to watch, especially if they've never witnessed or been part of a dying process before. To see somebody dying in front of you is incredibly difficult, and it's scary. And things, icky things happen. I won't go into graphic detail here. You're welcome. But, you know, when those things start happening, or if their person is having some scary looking symptoms, to have somebody besides hospice too to just hold their hand and say, this is okay, this is normal, this is what's going to happen, let it process, let it go, let's talk about it, where you've, you know, I'll talk to their feelings. Like Greg said, you know, there's going to be anger, there's going to be bad feelings, and it's not always comfortable. There's going to be uncomfortable moments too. And I think having somebody in the room who has seen it before or who understands a little bit, just to be a reassurance that, yeah, this is hard. This is icky. This is gross. And I'm so sorry this is happening. Our bodies do icky, gross things when we die sometimes. But to have somebody to just reassure you that it's okay, we'll get through this.
And you guys also go through not only how somebody wishes to spend their final days, even their final moments, but you also help them plan how they want their funeral to look, how they want sort of their legacy to be viewed, correct? Like you go through from before, during, and after.
Yeah. And I'm not a funeral director, so I can't do any of that. Absolutely. But I can, if they have special rituals they want done, like as soon as they take their last breath, they want a prayer to be read, or they want a song to be sung, or a drum circle. I can ensure that that's going to happen. So as soon as their last breath is taken, the family can come together, hold hands and sing a song, or they can tell a joke if that's what the person wanted. Yeah, whatever your like final moments you want them to be or thereafter, I can help you navigate that. Or if you have questions about, you know, what are my options as far as funerals and end of life practice, you know, afterlife practices, I can guide you, give you a little bit of information that I have, but I can't lead a funeral.
No, but you can even help have conversations with the family about, you know, embalming, no embalming, cremation, burial, what we all want that to look like.
Yeah, and there's a lot of options. There are a lot of options out there right now.
I love that you mentioned telling a joke. I think people forget that we can be funny, that there's humor at the end of life. And it's not about the, you know, our sense of humor, although Nikki and I are very funny people. It's about our honoring the whole client, honoring the whole person, and recognizing that humor, not just as a coping mechanism, but as something that brings you joy in life, is going to be important at the end. And I think about one of my favorite clients who I just recall so fondly, and there was a moment where everyone was circling bedside, and she was just entering the stages of actively dying, and she looked up and looked around at everybody and said, and I'll give the censored version, why is everyone so serious? You know, and it just, everybody started laughing, and it was just this incredible feeling of love and humor that wrapped over the room. And there are some times where we are going to be the only ones brave enough to acknowledge that that part is still living on in our client, because everybody else is going to be so sad in the room. And if we can meet them where they are and give an outlet for that, that's such a gift.
So as anyone who has made a birth plan knows, your vision for what you want can quickly go off the rails. How do you navigate when, say, a death plan takes a turn?
Well, and again, that's where we have to think on our feet, and we always have to have a plan B. I will try to encourage having a couple plans, because you are correct. Things definitely can not go the way you plan. You make a plan, God laughs, they say. So Greg and I are both improvisers. We have a little bit of history with improvisation. So knowing how to think on your feet, jump in and come up with a second plan. But most of all, keeping a calm space, because if something's going awry, the last thing the family needs is to see panic. So if nothing else, just to be that calm voice, say, okay, this isn't going as we planned. Let's take a step back, see what else we can do in place of XYZ.
And if you have a question for our death doulas or end-of-life doulas, does it matter which one I use?
Does not matter.
Okay. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides at wosu.org. And I want to read an email that came in that's particularly sad. Donna personally had an attorney experience where the involved attorneys, one representing herself and one representing her brother, she says they stoked animosity, and her brother threatened to sue her because she was the executor. And she says, basically abused me psychologically in order to extort. And for someone who's in intense grief, she had difficulty understanding what was happening. And I think family estates, they really can bring out the worst in us.
Yes. Yes, they absolutely can. Again, this is where I can't emphasize enough to get things in writing. Although, if you have a really good attorney, they can find a way to break those things. So,
You would think naming an executor would be enough.
That you think that would be simple enough. But I've personally heard many stories of people who are executors and their siblings came in and did everything they could to take that away. I would just take a step back and tell everybody to think for a minute, if you're going to do that, how much money that costs to go through the legal system. And that's stripping everything away from what was left to you, not just financially, but spiritually as well. If you're one of those people, don't do that. It's just not nice.
My heart goes out to this listener. It's a really tough situation and one that I don't think we can fix in this time, but it really, I appreciate them sharing because it really just lends another reason to why it's so important to have these conversations when we can still have these conversations together. And if we're scared about it, if we don't want to have those difficult conversations with our loved ones, this can so often be the result because there's no opportunity for clarifying questions and to continue the conversation and to ask the what ifs and to ask, well, what's the intent behind that? And if we can really just step up as the dying person and say, these are the conversations that are important to me. And if you don't feel you have the strength to do that alone, that's exactly when a doula might be the person to support you through that process.
In some ways, it makes me think of like an intervention. That's a weird way to think about it. But like you as the dying person go with your support doula and say, look, this is what I've decided. This is what I want. I just like really want you to get on board.
Mm-hmm. And that can be a tricky space if somebody has had maybe a change of faith in their life and they are facing the end of life and they want to experience their end of life in their new faith, and maybe their family might be part of something different. And that can be a huge point of animosity with family, and to have an advocate to try to see that through, but also, you know, be available to the family to say, you know, I appreciate you want a different experience, but this is what they're wanting. And if you love them, let's honor that. Let's have them be in this. You're only going to die once, so you need to do it on the terms you want.
How do you work with, say, pastors, rabbis, other faith leaders? How do you coordinate with them?
Those are some of my favorite people. I seriously, when I was exploring what to do in my midlife career change, when I was drawn to end-of-life care, I was really considering becoming a chaplain and just couldn't get over the fact that I couldn't get around my skepticism. And so I was looking for another way to support people. One of the big impulses behind me becoming an end-of-life doula was I had a friend who received a terminal diagnosis, and I didn't know how to react. I am a white male in the Midwest who was not taught to express feelings openly. I had to do that work later in life and come into that on my own. And when my friend was delivered this news, I was with her and didn't know what to say. And so my knee-jerk reaction was to go get a chaplain. And the chaplain came in, and my friend said, why are you bringing this person into my room? You know that I have a complicated relationship with organized religion. And I realized, well, she still deserves spiritual support. And so in some ways, we're that person we can be that person for people that are hiring us or working with us because they don't have a faith community to provide that emotional or spiritual support. But you're absolutely right to ask that question, because in other cases, we're not that person at all. That people that hire doulas are devout members of faith communities with incredible circles of support through their congregation and with communities rallying behind them. And in those cases, we might not be allowing them to investigate life's deeper questions, but we might just be coordinating those efforts so that the people that want to help know what to do more efficiently. Although in other cases, sometimes we're that person that somebody might express doubt to. They might be afraid of letting down their pastor or their rabbi, and they don't want to express that doubt, and they can share it with us, and we can hold it like a closely guarded secret so that they feel seen in those moments that maybe they don't want to share that with a spouse or a faith leader.
Oh, that's a really good point. That was Greg Brown, an end-of-life doula instructor. Coming up, we're continuing our conversation on dying and what it means to have a, quote, good death. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're spending this hour with two end-of-life doulas talking about their jobs and how they can help you cross from this life into whatever comes next. Still with me are Nikki Smith, an end-of-life doula and grief coach here in Columbus, and Greg Brown, an end-of-life doula instructor for the University of Vermont. So at the beginning, I talked about all the different names, right? End-of-life doula, grief coach, death doula. Does the name matter? And if so, why?
The name does matter. And one of the things I really admire about Nikki is the willingness to use the word death doula. That I think as doulas, we wear two hats. We're advocacy doulas and we're client doulas. And I think it's important as an advocacy doula to not be somebody that is afraid to use the word death. And when we say end of life doula, we don't want to say it because we're avoiding using the word death. And the more that we can say the word death, the more people are going to hear us and be talking about it and not afraid to participate in these conversations. And so I think it's a very intentional choice to identify as a death doula so that you're identifying as somebody that's not going to shy from that stigma, and that you're there to normalize people that are thinking about these things and to encourage them to keep talking about it. Where we say end-of-life doula and why the University of Vermont program uses the phrase end-of-life doula is because a dying person has every right to be treated as if they're a full living person to the very moment of their last breath. I think about my own mother, who never informed me of her diagnosis. And reading through her diaries after she died, I learned that it wasn't because she was really scared, but it was she didn't want to be treated any differently. She wanted to be honored as the feisty person she was and not, you know, tiptoed around. And so by emphasizing the word life, we're reassuring people that, yes, even though we're all going to die and we're no longer going to be scared of using the phrase death, but you're going to be working with somebody that's going to treat you like the full, valid, exceptionally awesome person that you are until that very last breath.
I want to take a call from Amy in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask about, what about doulas across state lines, and what about doulas for those left behind? In my case, I'm in Ohio. My parents lived in New York. I had a matter of days to get myself out to New York and watch my father die in a hospital room. My dad died 10 years ago, and my mom died 8 years ago, and I'm still dealing with the aftermath. I'd like to know, I support the doula idea tremendously because it's certainly needed, but in my case, how do I get a hold of somebody who's several states away to be there with my dad? And what you were saying right before you took my call, the dignity of the person, that was something that was markedly lacking. And if I had it to do over again, I would do it differently. So what can we do about if we're several states away and we don't have the luxury of time, how do we get a hold of a doula to be with your family member? And how do the family members left behind seek help to rectify the feeling that they have done a very poor job of standing up for their parents?
Yeah,
if you could address that, I would greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm so sorry you experienced that, first of all. You can absolutely hire doulas across state lines. I've consulted people via Zoom several states away. So there's a couple ways you can find doulas in a different state. You can just Google search death doula in XYZ state. Enelda, where I receive my training, has a directory on their website, and you can search by country. There are doulas all over the world. You can search by country, city, state, and find something close. Call them, reach out to them to explain the situation, see if that's where their specialties are. And as far as families left behind, this is part of the reason I went through initial training for grief coaching, because I have so many people I have spoken with that have already experienced a loss, and they're confused as to whether or not they went through it, quote unquote, the right way, or they feel like it was a terrible experience and they just need some validation as far as, somebody to say, I'm sorry, it was a terrible experience, you know, that you didn't do anything wrong, and just help validate their feelings.
Yeah, it's hard when you think it didn't go the way that you hoped it would.
It's even harder if you're several states away. Again, that's why you can consult with people in other states. Just, you know, look for a directory, Google search, find somebody, make those phone calls, make a connection.
Yeah, my dad died during COVID. So the hospital had this rule where my mom could be in the room, and there's 6 kids.
Oh.
And we had to rotate. And so we just took shifts, and, you know, it was sort of like playing it a really dark game of who was going to be there when he died, because we all couldn't be in the room together because of COVID restrictions.
That's honestly part of why I got into this line of work, is stories like yours and other stories of people close to me that either didn't get to be present with their family member, or their family member lived too far away, or they experienced a terrible, terrible loss or end-of-life experience with a family member. And it breaks my heart. And if I could make sure every single human in the world had a perfect death, I would, but I can't. I'm only one person.
Yeah. So in some ways, and I don't know if this is a weird question, is an end-of-life doula kind of like a project manager?
Yeah. My husband and I have a background in theater. He still works in theater, and he once referred to me as the stage manager for death. In a way, we kind of are project managers, because we can help facilitate things like I talked about at the beginning, as far as how do I know if I'm ready for hospice? How do I get hospice? What questions should I ask when I'm looking at different hospices? Who do I want in the room with me? Who do I not want in the room with me? That's a big one. If you have a family member that you are not on the same lines with, and you don't want them anywhere near you at your end of life experience, again, to have somebody as an advocate to step in and say, I'm sorry, you can't be here. But just to keep all those loose ends together and to set up a legacy. How do we want to leave the world behind a little bit better because of you were in it?
Yeah, no, sometimes that's really, as weird as this sounds, when I was having my first daughter, my parents kept calling. It took a long time. It was like 3 days to have her. It was a whole, I had everything but the C-section. And my parents were obviously worried, and they kept calling and calling and calling. And finally, my midwife picked up the phone and was like, she's busy. We'll call you later. It's okay. Like, just having her, because my husband was really busy. I was really busy. But just having that person there to be like, no, not right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have had requests of that, of certain family members they don't want present. I've never had to, like, you know, go to fisticuffs or block a doorway or anything yet, knock on wood, but I'm ready if that, that comes to it.
So, and you keep, both of you have touched on this idea of end-of-life doulas having different areas of specialization. Can you kind of walk us through what some of those are, Greg?
Well, for me, one that comes to mind is I'm a music theorist by training.
Oh.
I spent my life teaching how to think about, criticize, analyze classical music. And what I've really learned is that I'm pretty good at seeing patterns, and I'm pretty good at finding meaning in ephemeral things that are really hard to name. And if somebody is struggling to figure out what their life meant, if somebody doesn't feel like their life has been completed in some meaningful way, I really can sit there for hours and listen to stories and identify these themes and these threads and figure out how can we weave these together to form a narrative that is comforting to you, and to maybe we'll do some writing projects together.
Oh, I love that.
And then, of course, music at the bedside is one of the it's an absolute joy to either play piano or sing for somebody, or just to curate a playlist of the songs that bring them peace and meaning. And for me, I think when some people think about end-of-life doulas, they think of somebody who's going to come in all woo-woo and set up shop with incense and crystals and Enya, who I love Enya, but that's not the point. But what we really need to do is to say, what music brings you meaning? And to, I don't have an idea of what's going to be soothing and peaceful to you, but I'm going to ask you enough questions where I can figure that out and what it is that you want there. And so, yeah, there's nothing I enjoy more than putting together a playlist of the things that I think are going to allow you to really zone in on and wonderful memories throughout your life.
And while you guys said that you don't have to be a health practitioner, I've heard that there are some end-of-life doulas who formerly were hospice nurses or oncology nurses, right? So sometimes they have that dual role, but not always.
Correct. And there, most of the hospice, or I'm sorry, end-of-life doulas I've met have been hospice nurses, or worked in hospice in some capacity and saw those gaps where they couldn't stay with a patient as long as they wanted. And every end-of-life doula I know that is or was a nurse will not do that medical part. They separate themselves, and they have either an agreement or verbal, nonverbal that, or written, I'm going to be your nurse or I'm going to be your end-of-life doula, and I will not do both.
But I would think they also can bring some of that knowledge about what maybe physically is happening at end of life, or
absolutely,
like when somebody looks like they're getting close, so to speak.
And I think that a client who hires a doula has a right to expect that your doula will be educated in those basic pathways to end of life and what they will look like, to be able to narrow in on those cues to know, oh, it might be time to call the cousins and let them know to come say goodbye if they have to book a flight still.
We're getting down to the end of our hour together, and I just wanted to know, how do you guys take care of yourselves? Because this has to be such difficult work.
Yeah, I get this question all the time, is how do you not, you know, lose your mind working with people at end of life? And I have my own practices of self-care. I'm a fitness person. I go out for runs if I have to. I go for long walks if I need to. But I have little rituals I do after I lose a client on my own. I'll have a little cry. I'll do a little song. I'll do a little dance, whatever I need to do. But I have my own private little rituals I do to allow myself to grieve, because I might be their end-of-life doula, but I've become part of their family, especially if I've been with them for a long period of time. I get close to them, and I'm absolutely broken and sad when they leave. So I allow myself the time and space to grieve as much or as little as I need. I can call Greg, or I can call any of the other death doulas I know here in Columbus and talk it out if I have to.
For me, that's been a really interesting journey. Self-care is a call to balance. And before I was doing this line of work, I was a cab driver, putting myself through grad school for a while. Pretty intense life where I needed to relax. Now I'm relaxed all the time. I'm the calmest person in the room, in a hospital room or a hospice room or in a client's living room. And so my self-care, I'll see you in the Nordeca cheering on the Columbus crew. I'll see you on the improv stage making inappropriate jokes and laughing. And that's how I find that balance in my own life.
That was Greg Brown, an end-of-life doula instructor based here in Columbus. Thank you so much. And Nikki Smith, an end-of-life doula and grief coach, also here in Columbus. Thank you. And that will do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.